friends, this is Tim Binal of binalofamerica.com with another edition of Binal of America Audio. It is February 25th, 2006. This week we have a monstrous interview for you. When I first launched Binal of America Audio, I wanted Lauren Coleman on the show. And finally, the stars have aligned, and Lauren Coleman is here this week on Binal of America Audio. I'm totally psyched for Lauren Coleman to be on the show this week, folks, because I am a lifelong Bigfoot enthusiast. Before I even got into UFOs, I was into studying the Bigfoot, so to finally have a chance to speak with Lauren Coleman after having read his books and heard him on the radio numerous times, it was just a learning experience for me personally, and hopefully it will be for all of you. We discuss cryptozoology inside and out, all kinds of cryptozoological beasts, and various ponderances from me, questions that I have never heard Lauren Coleman asked, and try to get inside his head. And then, as if that's not enough, we discuss Lauren Coleman's book, The Copycat Effect, which is about how the media influences popular culture through over-coverage of stories. And so we do both sides of Lauren Coleman, and we discuss how he balances being both the world's leading cryptozoologist and one of the world's most respected speakers on the topic of suicide, suicide clusters, and media influence on popular culture. It's an amazing discussion, and it's this week on Binal of America Audio. Let's talk a little bit about Lauren Coleman before we kick off the interview. He's one of the world's leading cryptozoologists. Started his fieldwork and investigations in 1960 after traveling and trekking extensively in pursuit of cryptozoological mysteries. Coleman began writing to share his experiences in 1969. Since then, he's written 17 books and more than 300 articles. He's appeared frequently on radio and television programs and has lectured throughout North America, as well as in London and at Loch Ness. He's been both on- and off-camera consultant to Unsolved Mysteries on NBC, Ancient Mysteries on A&E, In Search of History on the History Channel, In the Unknown on Discovery Channel, and other reality-based programs. He contributes cryptozoological columns on the trail to London-based magazine Fortean Times and Mysterious World to Fate magazine, as well as regular articles to The Anomalist and Fortean Studies. He has also written extensively in human services, having authored, co-authored, or edited 8 books, including the critically acclaimed Suicide Clusters, appeared on The Larry King Show to discuss it, and his work on the suicides of baseball players was covered in Sports Illustrated, Sporting News, ESPN, ESPN Classics, and all the major media and wire services. So he's got a 1-2 punch, cryptozoology and copycat effect, this week on Binal of America Audio. The interview was conducted on January 23rd, 2006. Lauren Coleman on Binal of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Binal of America Audio. I'm really psyched to have as the guest this week Lauren Coleman. He is literally tops in the field of cryptozoology. I'd say he's the father of modern-day cryptozoology, if you will. So it's pretty rare that I get the opportunity to speak to someone who's at the top of the field. So I'm really excited, and I've been a lifelong seeker of the Bigfoot. So for me, it's even better because I've just been fascinated with Bigfoot my whole life, even before I got into UFOs. So to speak with Lauren Coleman is just an honor and a privilege. And ladies and gentlemen, Lauren Coleman, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Tim.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about your background and how you ended up getting into the entire cryptozoology realm? Because obviously people ask me all the time how I got into this, and that's fascinating. And you're so out there and popular, and you're such a, like a star in at the esoteric world that I haven't really heard your background, even though I've heard you on the radio a lot.
Yeah. Well, it really started for me in 1960. I was 12 years old, and I had really envisioned myself growing up to become a zoologist or study animals in some way, in some fashion. I had my own home zoo. I grew up in the Midwest in Illinois, and so I had all kinds of, mammals and snakes and turtles and different things. I'd gather some of them during the summer and have this huge backyard zoo, and then at the end of the summer release them back in the wild and start all over again.
Oh, wow.
The ones that I, were mammals and like hamsters, things like that, I would bring inside, of course.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was doing all of that, very interested in science, bright student in school and all of that, and all of a sudden, one night in March, I saw a fiction film a science fiction film really called Half Human, and it was done by the same director, Hondo, I found out later, who went on to do Godzilla and did Rodan and all of those famous movies. But just before he had done this movie in 1957 in Japan, he had been a documentary filmmaker. So when he made Half Human, it looked to me, even as a 12-year-old, like a documentary. It talked about these native peoples in the mountains who were reporting a thing they called the snowman. And then it showed these Westerners, David Carradine. His father, John Carradine, was in it as a character actor, as they often did back then for movies they brought over to America. Anyway, they looked for the abominable snowman. They finally captured and killed a young one and put it on a table, did all examinations. And as chance would have it, back to reality of me watching the TV show, that show was rebroadcast again on a Saturday morning, the next Saturday morning. So I actually got a double dose of brainwashing. And then I went to school the next week, and I said, what is this about the abominable snowman? And almost to one, every one of my teachers said, don't waste your time. Don't read anything about this.
Yeah.
You know, all of that stuff. So what did I do? I went to the library and got everything I could on the abominable snowman and the Yeti, and found out there was something here. It was one of those. I had been at the time already reading the books of Charles Fort, the Book of the Damned, and all of those. So I was kind of questioning authority and questioning all of these higher scientific commitments to only looking one way and not the other. So I just got more and more into it and found very quickly that there were reports of Black Panthers in Illinois. I found out about Bigfoot. I found that Ivan Sanderson in 1961 wrote a book called Abominable Snowman, Legend Come to Life. I wrote him. Altogether, probably, I think it was by the time I was 14, I had 400 correspondents around the world.
Oh, wow.
I was already out in the field doing field work, going with game wardens, investigating cases.
Oh, wow.
Writing and gathering material. So much so that Ivan Sanderson, who was one of my correspondents at the time, thought I was like in my 50s. So I just got more deeply into it, and just one decision I would make after another would be based upon my interest in cryptozoology. I finally, when I went to college, my father was a professional firefighter. My mother was a housewife, and you know, basically a working class family, struggling. And I needed to go to a state school, so I picked out a state school, Southern Illinois University, because they had a long folklore tradition around there of little apes in the woods. And actually went down there and studied anthropology, graduated with a degree in anthropology and zoology. And so that, you know, I decided to move to California, and I moved to California for a couple of years to do some investigations there. In the meantime, I was traveling all the time. I was hitchhiking. I was getting in my car. By now, it's 45 years later, and I've been to every state in the United States except Alaska. And I've lived in the Midwest and in the West and now in New England since 1975.
Wow.
So, just one late thing led to another.
Yeah.
And I wrote my first article, I think it was 1969, my first book in 75. So I've gone from field work to investigative work to chronicling the situation, as well as, like you say, to some people, a media star, which I hardly think about. It does happen, and yet I still do field work, and actually the media seems to be one of the major sources of funding these days, because documentary film companies can fly you into areas that you hardly can afford to go to anymore.
Yeah. Now, the first big picture sort of question I have for you, because you know the Bigfoot as well as anybody, if money were no object, how would you go about capturing the Bigfoot?
Well, I think that we need to really refocus our brain in terms of the way that new animals are always discovered. And they're always discovered by knowing the local wildlife and also knowing the local people. And so what I would do with, millions of dollars of funding, I would set up groups of two or three people in different pocketed areas, wilderness areas around the country, just like, you know, rethink the Diane Fossey and the Jane Goodall model.
Yeah.
Which was Louis Leakey's, really, they were they were the women that he would send out. I mean, he talked to all of these women about, we need to know more about primates and the great apes so that we can understand prehistoric man. And I think that's exactly the key to animal collecting or collecting information. So then I would pick out certain areas in Northern California and British Columbia and the Yukon and really and find some people that want to do Survivor for 6 months or 8 months.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen with a bunch of weekend warriors that are, have all of the technology in the world and all of the high-tech equipment. I think it's really going to be low-tech and somebody smelling like a skunk after they come out, but at least that's the way the other animals in the area won't notice them and Bigfoot will come closer.
Yeah, yeah. So you just can be patient pretty much and
sure.
And situated in the environment.
Right, exactly.
Now, if I recall correctly from your book, you fall on the side of the no-kill sort of debate within the Bigfoot world. If we're going to get close enough to it in a situation, do you take it down or not? And you're on the not side, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think about it as a debate anymore. I think it's just, if you look at what happened during the turn of the century during Victorian times, between the 19th and 20th century, that was the obvious way to collect animals. You could go out and you shoot a bunch of them and you figure out which ones are the new ones. But we know now the animal populations are so low, and if there is a Bigfoot out there or Yeti out there, the numbers, the breeding population in any one area is going to be so small, you won't want to kill one. And so that's where I do think that we need to rely on high technology. And a friend of mine, Mark Hall, actually calls it telebiology, where you do capture, and then release. But you capture one of these creatures, you photograph them, you take blood samples, DNA, you observe them for a long amount of time, maybe even setting up a reservation, a preserve, a habitat. This is like a living zoo that may be hundreds and hundreds of acres, and then release them into that with, a microchip in so you can track them and all of that.
Yeah.
But I think it's really, I've often said in a joking but somewhat serious way, then maybe we will discover Bigfoot when a lumber truck in Maine hits one, or a
yeah.
lumber truck in British Columbia. And so I'm not against, obviously, taking advantage of the fact that accidents do occur, that animals are killed, that animals die naturally, and maybe we'll find a body, and we should take that. But I am... And I actually think that these creatures, these cryptids, have higher senses of smell and some other factors where they don't really, that they actually avoid guns and gun oil and different things like that. So guns tend to get in the way of hunting Bigfoot as opposed to helping.
Yeah. Now, last year I read an article that was about how there's this East Coast versus West Coast Bigfoot researcher feud, if you will. You probably know the article I was talking about. I think it was in the Washington Post or the New York Post or the New York Times, one of those.
Yeah.
Is that an extenuation, you think, of the ongoing, continuing generational feuds that seem to erupt over the search for Bigfoot?
Well, I think if you find any anomalous field, and if you look at Bigfoot and Abominable Snowman and cryptozoology, you will find different divisions. For one thing, I think, and I believe that was the Post, had that article in there mainly to create a media sensation. I think the media is always looking for friction,
yeah.
always looking for an angle. So if you look at most of the new people that are involved, even newer than me, obviously, they're coming out of the East Coast. Ohio and some of the other states out east have high populations of new researchers. Some of the older, the four horsemen, like Peter Byrne and John Green and Rene de Hinden and Grover Krantz, those all were Western individuals. Ivan Sanderson once told me in 1965 I was the only person in the East that was digging up Eastern cases.
Yeah.
So if I look back at it and think, 65 to now, 40 years later, there's obviously going to be a lot of new people, and I've produced a lot of articles, and other people have, of course, so that more and more people get involved. But I do think that the thing that goes on with the Western researchers, because they're not open to the data from the East, they tend to think This is one species. This is one concentrated population in the Pacific Northwest, and that everybody else is hallucinating, and they really aren't finding footprints. And in other words, all of the criticisms that they hear from regular scientists in the media about their West Coast Bigfoot, they then lump on into the same debunking that they give out for the East Coast. So it's kind of intriguing trend to see. But I have friends on both coasts, and I really feel like, you know, I don't want to be in this feud, but it does occasionally happen that the big symposium, for instance, at Willow Creek, at a certain point after I was invited to go and speak, then the local Chamber of Commerce and some other local funders decided this was only going to be open to West Coasters. So there can be things that are set up that just creates additional friction.
Yeah. Now, like you were saying about how the West Coast seems to think that it's just one pocketed species, in your book you point out that you think it might be, I want to say, three species of Bigfoot. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think that types is a word that I'm much more comfortable with.
Okay.
For instance, the Eastern Bigfoot, or the marked hominid, as I sometimes call it, or as the native people sometimes use the one word, Wendigo. There may be actual geographic races, differences between the West and the East Coast Bigfoot, per se. I do think that there's a vastly different species, a much more chimpanzee, going around on all fours, smaller, smells much more in the South, that really is dramatically shown by the name skunk ape in Florida.
Yeah.
And I think that population is really very much a different species than the Bigfoot.
Yeah.
But I do think that Bigfoot's an ape. It's just an ape that's evolved in a different way than most great apes have today.
Okay, now this is kind of intriguing. Usually when I have a guest coming up for the show, I email the two of the writers from my website and ask if they have questions. Almost always they never have any questions, but this time each of them had a question. So,
oh, great.
Yeah, so I want to take care of those, make sure I take care of these questions right away. First is Leslie. You might be familiar with Leslie. She has the Debris Field blog. She writes for us on Tuesdays. She wanted to know about, she heard a story about a year ago about giant bears around Siberia, and she wanted to know if you knew anything about that.
Yeah, there's a speculation in Siberia that one of the Pleistocene, you know, the last ice age, giant bears, which are related to the brown bears except a little bit bigger, do exist. And there's hunter folklore from up there that does talk about those. And I do mention in my book Cryptozoology A to Z. So there does seem to be some areas in Siberia that has good wilderness, good, you know, a kind of distance from human habitat where we would expect some possibility of bears would exist like that.
Okay, and now the other writer is Chiron. He's Michael is his real name, but he goes by Chiron, and he writes for Chiron.net and BenAllOfAmerica.com. And he's done a lot of covering of a lot of the stuff that you were involved with the thing last October, and then he also covers a lot of cryptozoology and that giant squid story that came about last year. And he wants to know, in light of the recent news with the giant squid, what's left to be done in the hunt for Bigfoot or Nessie? Like, where's cryptozoology going next? Where does it need to go next?
Well, first of all, I think there's a little misunderstanding about the giant squid story. The giant squid, of course, were discovered and verified in the 1870s. And what the media kind of messed up on was saying that all of this giant squid, like the giant squid has never been verified as an animal before and has been part of cryptozoology. But the videotapes that the Japanese took last year, or really the news that they announced that they'd taken them the year before, were the first live videotapes of giant squid. We knew that giant squid existed. So it's interesting to see how excited people can get when they just hear about the live footage of the coelacanth, which was discovered in 1938, the giant fish that blew off of the coast of South Africa that supposedly was extinct for 65 million years, but now we know were not. They were only videotaped in the 1990s, and that once again was an exciting bit of news. So every time we discover an animal doesn't necessarily mean that we know what they look like live in the wild, and that's why I think the giant squid story was so famous.
Yeah.
I think that, at the end of every year I do predictions of, not predictions, but an overview of the stories for the year, and I also mentioned that there's sightings of a relative of the ivory-billed woodpecker, which is the imperial woodpecker of Mexico. I have a feeling we may have more woodpecker stories out this year. There's news and excitement coming out of new expeditions for Mokelio Mbembe to Africa this year. That's another area that kind of has been quiet for a while. It is following intriguingly on the heels of news during 2005 that four individuals that were closely related to the Mokelio Mbembe, which is supposedly the dinosaur that lives in the Congo,
yeah,
and the Cameroons, that they died during the year, and yet here's just once again you're seeing the mantle from a whole generation of Mokelio Mbembe hunters being passed on to a younger generation of people that are on expedition right now in the Cameroons. The ape stories from Africa, I think, could really stimulate something. And once again, I don't think we should ever sell Bigfoot short. There's this Sasquatch Dumpling Gang movie coming out this year.
Yeah.
Done by the same people that did Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's going to be a funny comedy. It's already getting good reviews. It's at some of the festivals out west already. But what I noticed is there's oftentimes... if there's something happening in the popular art culture, then you'll get news on the real basis. We got the at Bates University, we're going to have the big cryptozoology exhibition occurring this year, then moving to Kansas. I think that'll stimulate interest. The photo competition for the Dual Masters photos, that ends in February 2006. We're probably going to hear about what those photographs showed. And then Disney down in Disney World is opening their new Yeti exhibit.
Oh, wow.
So, just all those little things tend to then, at least in North America, get people looking around and talking about Bigfoot and,
yeah,
and moving out into the woods. So it could be an exciting year.
Awesome. Awesome. Why don't you talk a little bit about that whole adventure from last October with the $1 million bounty on Bigfoot that was put out by, I think, the company you said earlier, too, right?
Yeah, Dual Masters, Wizards of the Coast, Hasbro Company. Well, what happened, of course, was they had an idea that the Dual Masters is a trading card game for youngsters in the 13 to 15-year-old age, mostly males, but also I think all kinds of different people play those games.
Yeah.
And they have, some of them have monsters on them, and some of them are creations that are close to the monsters. So their whole, it's a very big phenomena in Japan, and the Dual Masters people are interested in stimulating some interest in the United States. So they had an idea early in October, and they were going to release the news late in October, that they were going to put out a $1 million bounty for a picture of the Loch Ness Monster, Yeti, or Bigfoot, that would lead to the capture of one of these. So it was going to be the kind of thing that they felt, and they started, their lawyer started reading what I guess the other part of the company had put out as a test floater.
Yeah.
And they started understanding that there might be people killed out in the woods,
yeah, yeah,
trying to shoot Bigfoot or capture Bigfoot, when that's not what the contest was about. It was about a photograph.
Yeah.
So... and they had hired me to assist them with the, you know, coming up with the right kind of language and different things like that,
mm-hmm,
and given me permission to release that news at a couple of conferences in Texas and at Bates College in Maine late in October. So when it came closer to that, the lawyers really made them withdraw the $1 million, but they put out $9,000 in real prizes that are actually guaranteed to be given away, and all the top prize, for instance, and these are all about the photographs of anything that could be used to convince someone or show as evidence of Bigfoot, Yeti, or the Loch Ness Monster. So you know, you can't do any photoshopping, can't do any computer enhancement, but they, I think that what will happen is some people are going to send in photographs of a Bigfoot prints or of habitat where they think that there's a Bigfoot, and it's going to be interesting because they are giving away the prize, and I actually am going to be on one of, on the panel to judge it. And it won't be the kind of thing where we're going to give prizes for, you know, your grandmother's second relative dressing up in a gorilla costume. It's got to be something that really enhances cryptozoology.
Now, you see some of the stuff that's coming in already, or are they holding on to that?
No, they hold on that until the contest ends February 3rd.
That's a good thing, though, that they're giving out that kind of money, and that probably generates, like you said, a lot of interest in people.
Yeah, I think they're rightfully using the word cryptozoologist in training. And it is amazing to me to watch. I just did a lecture this week to a group of second and third graders, and I don't do that very often, but it was something that a local person wanted to do. And you know, there a lot of people are interested in cryptozoology, and their parents may be afraid that that's going to ruin their life, and they'll be interested in computers and games and cryptozoology all their life. And I don't see that happening at all. I see cryptozoology as a gateway to learning about animals and the environment, and really changing some people's lives away from just not being interested in anything.
Yeah. And now, during that time when the story came out, you were that was when I remember we were trying to set up the interview in the first place. You sounded like you were just inundated with media inquiries. What was that like to be all of a sudden thrust into that sort of situation?
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I remember one Wednesday I had 23 radio interviews and magazine interviews in one day. Went down to Texas and got interviewed by 11 news crews, you know, CNN, ESPN2, you know, a lot of local media, a lot of national media. So that happens occasionally during what I call media flaps. And the last one was when the Mothman movie came out, and I consulted to that. That was 2002. But what's happened since October is it's not stopped.
Oh, wow.
And that's one of the reasons we've had such a hard time is I've been flown out to G4 TV in LA and been on that show, the Attack of the Show, and I've been on weird travels on the Travel Channel. They came by the Boston Globe magazine's going to do a profile on cryptozoology. Down East magazine. You know, one thing after another, it's been nonstop, and there's not a week that goes by when I don't do two or three interviews.
Oh, man.
And then in addition, I'm trying to write books and, you know, investigate cases and take care of my family, too.
Yeah. Well, don't become too big a celebrity because the esoteric world needs you. We can't, lose you to some, you know, reality show or sitcom.
Oh, no, I'm not leaving.
Okay. Now, one of the things that always intrigued me was around the 90s when DNA all of a sudden became like a reliable scientific source. There were starting to come in some DNA samples what we thought were of Bigfoot, and they were always like unknown primate situations.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a study, or has anyone taken a look at these DNA samples and tried to compare them or try and create some kind of database, maybe find some comparisons and come up with some sort of standard in a way?
Well, first of all, I think people got very excited by DNA and saw it as a magic key to understand new animals, but you have to back up first, and one reason we keep getting inconsistent results, or looks like human but is not quite human, or inconsistent near ape, is that until we have a type specimen of a Bigfoot, of a Yeti, of any of these creatures, we're going to have all these hair samples, even some with usable DNA roots, and they're not going to tell us a darn thing because we don't have the type animal.
Yeah.
It's sort of, you know, and that's true with criminal forensic, you know, CSI kind of stuff, is you can have all of this evidence you want, but if you don't have the evidence from the criminal, from the human, then it's worthless. And that's what I think a lot of the debunkers and skeptics jumped on early on when DNA came out, because we do have hair. We do have, you know, I myself have hair from the 1950s and 60s from the Yeti expeditions to the Himalayas. And until we have an animal, they're really worthless because all they keep coming back as not human but near human.
Yeah.
And it doesn't tell us a thing. As far as the other part of your question, is there organizations to try to compare those? Yes. There's Henner, you know, Fehrenbach, who's out on the West Coast, has been a major force in collecting samples of hair. And he, like, I mean, I do a very minor part of it compared to him. He has a great, he used to be connected to one of the national primate centers in the country before he retired. So he has samples from all kinds of monkeys and apes and humans from around the world, as well as people tend to send him Bigfoot hair samples. I have samples of Yeti and Bigfoot and, you know, chimpanzee, orangutan, different gorilla, so, as well as, you know, all of the common domestic animals. But it's been very funny during the 1950s on one of the Tom Swick expeditions in California. They started getting hair samples, and they were in an area where these animals didn't exist, not the Yeti, but the one that they found out these samples were of, and it was of a moose. And so you know that you had some actual fakery and hoaxing going on.
Yeah.
And in the recent story from just last year of what was called the, you know, the Bigfoot sample from Yukon,
that
got all of the news, and it turned out to be a bison. And I talked to the scientist that was involved in the analysis of that, and it wasn't just a regular sample of bison hair. He said this was a bison hair that had been taken from a rug.
Huh.
He could tell from the process.
Oh, man.
So somebody had taken a tanned rug of a bison and actually faked that hair sample. So some people go to all kinds of lengths because they think it's a great laugh to hoax other people, but it tends to end up a complete waste of all of our time.
Yeah. So like you said, that the person up there in California, but they're comparing, like, what I'm interested in is sort of like you get the unknown primate, unknown but not human.
Right.
And he's compared them to each other, so like, are there any matches, sort of, in a way? Do you know what I mean? Is there like
there's some overall matches. That's why you'll hear from some of the West Coasters who got a new hair sample, and they say it's consistent with other Bigfoot hair that we've found before.
Yeah.
And this is not through DNA. This is mostly through microscopic structural comparisons.
Yeah.
And there are some consistencies that are coming out, but that's also, as opposed to going to the very expensive DNA analysis, a lot of the comparison with and finding of hoaxes is just, you can almost immediately look at some of the structure of these hair and see that they're, one of the most common things is people take it from hair brushes.
Oh, man.
From the bristles. So there's camel hair showing up. There's, you know, some exotic furs that aren't even of animals that exist in the United States.
Oh.
And that's because people are doing that kind of stuff.
Okay, now, let's take a look into the future. Let's say Bigfoot's captured. Okay, does that hurt cryptozoology in the long run? Because I know, like, once Bigfoot's captured, then he's in the world of zoology. He's no longer a crypto.
Right.
Do you think the field of cryptozoology will be hurting once it loses Bigfoot?
Oh, not at all. I think that it will be justification for further funding, and I can hear the people on their TV shows already talking about that. And I think if you look at it in a minor sort of way, the discovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker after 60 years, the discovery of the little people from Flores, the hobbits, as the media likes to call them, those have actually made cryptozoology, Henry Glee of Nature Magazine, the editor of Nature Magazine, he said cryptozoology can finally come in from the cold. And I think that's what's happening. Actually, cryptozoology right now is getting more substantially recognized as a science that needs to be treated seriously. And I saw that last October at the Bates College Symposium on Art and Cryptozoology. Here you had academics, as opposed to debating whether or not cryptozoology is worthwhile, they were talking about the history of cryptozoology and how cryptozoology influences different sciences and involves and informs art. And that's a whole new status for cryptozoology, as opposed to it being talked about as a pseudoscience. It's actually being talked, as Heuvelmans and Sanderson and myself have wanted for many years, that this is a sub-discipline of zoology. It may be a little more strange for some academics to deal with, but it certainly is based upon very thoughtful science.
Now, do you think that gives hope for maybe some of the other more esoteric sciences out there, like ufology and mostly ufology, really, but some of the other fringe science specializations? If cryptozoology is getting some respect finally, do you think that might, down the line, open up the doors for other areas?
I think it's a mixed bag, and I think one of the things that's been important for cryptozoology is to really separate itself from something like ufology.
Yeah.
I think that parapsychology, for instance, has done a very good job of coming up with results that are very measurable, and that's sort of why at some universities there are very serious courses on parapsychology. But the problem with ufology, mostly, and I think it's like if you ask somebody that purely studies ghosts and not some of the other things like poltergeist, is that ufology, studies of ghosts, studies of telepathy, although that's a little different, they're very like wisps of smoke.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say, are there people out there, did Roswell happen? Are there men in black? Are there UFOs? Those are so paranormal and without what Ivan Sanderson used to call the tangible intangibles, it's hard to get a grasp on them. Whereas cryptozoology, which really sees itself as coming out of zoology, we look for hair samples,
yeah,
body footprints, as well as folk art from natives, peoples, traditions that last 350 years. A lot of different things that actually have history, even linguistics. What this animal is called locally, how's it in the spirit world, how's it in the real world. You just don't get that kind of texture in ufology.
Yeah.
So it really seems to be different. And I don't know that cryptozoology becoming more accepted is going to help ufology at all, and I don't think that cryptozoologists really worry about that either.
Oh yeah, I know. I'm just asking sociologists.
No, I'm just giving a complete answer.
Okay. All right. And now, all right, we're still on this post Bigfoot's been captured world here.
I think it's going to do some things with religion and anthropology, though, that people haven't quite thought about it. Anthropology is going to be stirred up because most anthropologists have grown up in a world in which there have been only one human-like creature, and that's us, human,
yeah,
Homo sapiens. As soon as we find another bipedal creature, whether it's Arange Pindek over in Sumatra, or the Yeti, or the Bigfoot, that's going to shake up that science for a little while.
What do you mean by religion, though?
In terms of religion, I think that a lot of religious people are so bound up into human beings and being at the pinnacle, or the non-acceptance of evolution. If you discover Bigfoot, it could actually shake up religions that are so rigid they can't accept the possibility that there's evolution, or that these people, that they've just been around for the same amount of time as we have, or even if you get into, then it'll open up all kinds of things about other species over in Asia that may have interbred with humans. And it's just, once you find one of these big, very visible hominids around the world that are existing concurrently with us, it's going to open an amazing can of worms.
Wow, I never really thought about it like that, but you really make some good points there. So let's say one's been captured, the Bigfoot. How soon do you think afterwards would it be like they capture one Bigfoot, then next thing you know they can get him easily? Or is it going to be like we capture one and it's going to take another 50 years before we get another one?
Well, if our experience with other new animals is in the indication, it took us 60 years after the discovery of the giant panda to capture the first live one. And then it happened very quickly you're right, we knew where to go. But then again, it was a few months. If you look at the Sela camp, the first one was found in 1938, and then they didn't find the next one until 1952.
Oh, man.
So sometimes that does happen. And also the thing about Bigfoot that I keep stressing in a lot of talks I give is that our human interactions with Bigfoot is all chance. It's all just by the circumstances that we happen to be in the same area that they happen to be in. We don't really know what their lifestyle is day to day. We don't even know if they exist in the areas that they're being seen. They could be juvenile delinquent interlopers. You know, I think that if we look at most of the sightings, they tend to be males that are kind of thin, walking across highways and stuff like that. I think that those are your juveniles, those groups of juveniles that are out there, you know, roaming around and cruising. And they aren't the families. They aren't the real established populations. You have to dig into some stories and find when people see 2 and 3 and 4, and then you might be closer to the areas they're living. But I think that, so back to your original thing, where did we get this Bigfoot? Is it along a road? Is it a place that there was one Bigfoot that was accidentally there? Is that going to help us catch the next one or run into the next one?
Yeah.
Maybe not, because the one that we see may be somebody that's so out of place and so out of territory that it might take us another 20 years to get the next one.
Yeah, like you said, like someone could hit one by accident.
Right.
And that wouldn't help us, and that wouldn't, you know, lead us to any clues on how to search for them.
Right. I think the capturing the one and then doing all of the studies and making sure that it's verified and, you know, we can get all the funding, and then actually doing the microchip tracker and releasing it and seeing where they go.
Oh, yeah.
And are they hooking up with other ones, then that's, I think, what's going to teach us more.
Yeah. Now, kind of speaking to your book then, if it's sort of dangerous if some, like you said, weekend warriors, if they end up getting a Bigfoot, that could sort of end up being like a copycat effect where it could really hurt the Bigfoot population, do you think?
Yeah, I think it really, the initial thing is, who is the person that's really there as the first responder, as the first one to get the Bigfoot? If it's, you know, an accident and it's some housewife coming home from the grocery store in Durham, Maine, and she hits one, and then she gets in scientists and universities and the media, then you're going to have a situation. It will be a circus, but at least it will be a protected circus.
Yeah.
If you have a well-funded weekend warrior group that goes out and kills one, they're probably going to think, we can make millions of dollars off of this. So we're going to keep it under wraps for a while. We're going to try to find where others are. We're going to line up our agents. We're going to, you know, get a good deal on today's show and maybe a movie deal. And so you'll see it go a whole different route. And I think that's really the difference between who is the person that first has this interaction with this dead or live captured Bigfoot, and then what happens from that. And it could be a very different story. And you really saw that somewhat around the ivory-billed woodpecker. The government and the, you know, Nature Conservatory and different groups like that stepped in when they already knew and they were convinced there was really an ivory-billed woodpecker. They got funding of over $1 million. They bought up houses in the habitat and around the area they were looking for it, kept it quiet for over a year.
Oh, wow.
And it was the big secret. It was like a black ops operation. And a lot of people reading about the ivory-billed woodpecker haven't read deeply into the stories to see how the government really actually got involved and actively kept this story quiet for, I think, almost 18 months. If that happens with Bigfoot, there's going to be such a reaction from, you know, people who are conspiracy-minded anyway.
Yeah.
And realistically, you'll wonder what the government's doing if they're doing something like that with a creature like Bigfoot.
Okay, now, you're pretty well-known in the field for not really, you don't pay much credence to the whole UFO, the paranormal Bigfoot aspects. So you don't think there's any sort of, like, paradimensional, you think it's just a straight-up animal, right?
Well, I think, let me In 1975 and 78, I wrote two books with Jerry Clark, The Unidentified and Creatures of the Outer Edge. And those books during 2006 are going to be republished with a new introduction, which I talk a little bit about this. I think that it's very easy for people to put myself and other individuals in a black and white, you know, either you believe this or you don't believe
yeah.
this. And my whole notion is that I really explored that question. I looked at what I call the Jungian collective unconscious, the projections of the planetary poltergeist, that there may be aspects of llama behavior and other individuals who can actually project physical things from their body or make other individuals think that they're seeing something physical. I explored that in those two books. I was satisfied that maybe that was part of what was going on. And instead, after those two books came out, everybody thought in 1978 that I was some kind of believer in paranormal, psychic Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly what I was saying. So I found it necessary to go back to my real background, which is anthropology and zoology, as a real firm nuts and bolts or flesh and blood, whatever word you want to use,
yeah.
cryptozoologist. And so most of my pronunciations, most of my insights, most of my tracking knowledge is on the physical Bigfoot and the physical cryptids. It still doesn't mean that I understand that there are some aspects of any of these sightings that could be parapsychological, that could be human psychology. I mean, I do have a degree in psychiatric social work, and I've done a lot of doctoral work in those areas, and know that part of the problem with any of these sightings is they're not simple. I think that probably 20% of them really are talking about an actual animal. But there's misidentifications, there's mental health problems with some of these eyewitnesses. And maybe there is a small fraction. But I think that in some of the lectures I've gone to and had to almost walk out on is where somebody gets up there and they're showing fake footage of a Bigfoot hopping over a fence, and they're trying to say that these Bigfoot are psychic Bigfoot, that they're related to some ancient Mayan tribe, and that they may be related to those people coming out of the UFOs. I just think that really does a disservice to all of those fine people out there doing really in-the-field, conscientious Bigfoot work,
yeah.
Where they're not even thinking about theories. They're just trying to collect information and evidence.
Since you're sort of like the go-to guy of the field, and everyone seems to turn to you a lot, do you find yourself frustrated dealing with, like you said, the guy showing the video of the Bigfoot hopping the fence or the hoaxers? And we don't need to really go into what happened this past summer with the infamous captured Bigfoot, but sure you have to come in and sort of straighten out all these Bigfoot stories that come out all the time. That must be frustrating.
Well, I think there's a couple things that go on. Those people that they're showing those obviously fake things, or they have their trumped up stories, they're not going to seek me out. They're not going to, their egos get in the way of what they're doing, and they certainly aren't collaborating with me. I collaborate with a lot of people that have credible evidence. It's the media that then comes to me and wants me to talk about that dubious individual there or that one over there.
Yeah.
And I just say some very simple things about, like with the one book that says that the Roger Patterson film was a fake. You look in that one book and there's two different stories about the one, the skin was from a horse and it had six pieces. Another, the skin was from a carnival guy and it had three pieces. So you can sometimes these individuals hang themselves with talking too much. And you got to see that this summer with the quote-unquote captured Bigfoot, in which the individual didn't even, you said on one program he'd seen it, and it became very clear very quickly that he hadn't seen it. And now he's around the country trying to, allegedly scam some other people with some news stories. And it's just, we have to watch out. And we've known about some of these people for 30 years, and they've just kind of, they go away for a while and come back, but, they leave track, so to speak.
Yeah. I think it's like that in a lot of these esoteric fields, too, that, there's always these people that are sort of more harm than good for the field.
Yeah, but most of the people that have had, I mean, I talk to 15-year-olds and 50-year-olds and 105-year-olds on my through emails all the time, and people are honestly bringing up their extraordinary experiences, and they're not looking to get publicity. They're not looking, you know, and sometimes I do have to honestly say to them, well, that sounds like it was an owl, or,
yeah.
You know, I bet that was a fisher.
Yeah.
Which is a type of animal that fools a lot of people. And, you know, people are very open to hearing what I say and saying, you know, well, that wasn't the chupacabra. It was a dog with mange and stuff like that. So everything's not weird out there. Some of it does have mundane explanations.
Well, speaking of the chupacabra, this thing seemed to come up in the 90s out of nowhere. Was this something that people had been talking about prior to the last 15 years, or is it pretty much a new crypto animal?
Well, no, it's one of those things where we have the media to thank for that. It very much, there's a Hispanic Oprah, and I believe her name is Christina.
Okay.
She has a program, and in 1995, she had a whole couple programs about the chupacabras being seen in Puerto Rico, and they were killing deer and goats and all of that kind of, you know, livestock.
Yeah.
And that jumped over the cultural barrier between Spanish and English, and that was the key to it. Within the Hispanic culture, the chupacabras has been around for a long time.
Oh, really?
And actually recently, together with some other associates, we discovered that there's the late 1960s or 70s, we're trying to date this exactly. There was an episode of Bonanza in which a Mexican worker was on the Cartwright's ranch, and he was talking about this creature, the chupacabras, which was killing livestock. And so you had this chupacabra story around for a long, long time. It just got to be the right time in 1995 because of the internet. Because what happened is, after Christina's show, Hispanic students all across the United States started creating websites.
Yeah.
And it was that, the internet, that really pushed along the chupacabra into the English speaking. And like I've said, it reminds me of Jennifer Lopez. You know, it's just a cultural thing and very cross-cultural.
Yeah.
We all know how much we're interested in Jennifer Lopez. So.
Well, obviously, do you think you're going to see the capture of Bigfoot in your lifetime? You probably get that question constantly, so what do you think?
Well, if I live 25 years, I think that it's the kind of thing that I mentioned the words passion and patience are the two watchwords of cryptozoology. And, you know, within 25 years, I figure if we look at it took 60, 70 years to find the first giant panda alive. It took that long to find the first mountain gorilla. And if you date the modern era of Bigfoot from 1958, when the name was given, when Jerry Crew found those famous footprints at Bluff Creek, then we're really still kind of getting into the September, October of Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And I don't think I need to worry yet. What I'm most interested in is making sure there's open-minded cryptozoologists after I leave. And that's why I like to popularize and write about cryptozoology. And, you know, I have that new blog of mine called Cryptomundo,
yeah.
Which really I try to keep people updated with the news quite regularly about what's going on in cryptozoology.
Now, what about the Loch Ness Monster? It seems to have kind of lost a lot of steam in the last, 15, 20 years. Is this sort of kind of like what you were saying with the media? Like, they'll pick up on it again in another few years, and it'll be like it never went away?
Yeah, I think it's a real ebb and flow of the media. They really get attached to something. And oh, this from November through January of 2006, November 2005 through right now, we have all of these stories from Malaysia of the Bigfoot.
Yeah.
But you're not hearing anything from Loch Ness. You're hearing maybe there was two or three sightings last summer. There's no very big flamboyant expeditions over there. There's no movies coming out that's talking about the last movie that anybody talks about with Loch Ness was the Werner Herzog mockumentary, which was really a joke called Incident at Loch Ness,
yeah.
Which was a spoof. And so as long as you're going to hear that that's the way people are talking about Loch Ness, and this whole business about that a few years ago that there was a quote-unquote deathbed confession and somebody said that they'd hoaxed the photograph, even though that person told the story about what he said it was 2 years before he died. And the reality is that everybody in the Loch Ness field has known that surgeon's photograph wasn't that great to begin with. He was, and one of the reasons that he kept it quiet was because he was up in Scotland having an affair with an assistant. So there's all these little backstories that people, don't know about with any of that stuff yet. Until it's Loch Ness's time again, it'll kind of be on the back burner.
And do you think it's sort of hurt by the fact that it's just in a pocket, sort of? It's just in that lake. It's not as mysterious as the Bigfoot, because it could kind of be anywhere. With the Loch Ness monster, you know it's in Loch Ness, so it's there, and you can't really mystify it as much.
Well, I don't know. When I went to Loch Ness in 1999, I felt like I'd finally come to the epicenter of cryptozoology.
Oh, really?
Here within one block area, you had two whole huge exhibitions on the Loch Ness Monster, and I thought that was amazing. You can't go anywhere without, buying souvenirs seeing souvenirs and seeing people that are very open to it. So Loch Ness and the Loch Ness Monster really have gone hand in hand. I think that when people go there, when they find out and start reading about Loch Ness and find out there's enough water in Loch Ness to bury every human being on Earth under 6 feet of water, then they know that something still could be hiding there.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about Cryptomundo, because this is sort of your new thing. It's been going on since October, I think, right? And everybody's talking about Cryptomundo. I'm not even joking. When I'm online, I see news links. I see Cryptomundo all the time, so... And you seem to be the brainchild behind that, so tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I'm one of the associates contributors. Craig Woolheater in Texas really had this idea, and so he's on it as one of the people, the bloggers. Then there's Rick Knoll, who is connected with the Skokum cast, and then recently John Kirk has joined from British Columbia. And he's very much interested in lake monsters. And what we're really committed to doing is appearing almost daily with the news that nobody else is talking about. And I think what we saw was, there's always, there's some good websites like the Anomalist, and you get, different people on Boing Boing really publishing some stuff like Dave. But there wasn't one place that we saw. There was lots of forums. There's lots of websites, and there's lots of Yahoo lists. I mean, I'm a member of 40 Yahoo lists.
Oh, wow.
But I started seeing that my energies, because so many people wanted so much from me, that I needed to concentrate and focus a little bit better, as opposed to responding to every comment that came. And I was doing that. I've been doing that since the 80s, I get 500 emails a day, and I try to return answers. In addition to doing all of the media and doing all of writing the books and going to, the Black Forest of Pennsylvania looking for Thunderbird. So I'm finding that blog and the whole idea of blogging is really a novel way to exist on the net, because you can kind of put one thought out for the day, or two or three as I often do, and then respond to people that want to respond to that, as opposed to going to searching for conversations or conversations coming to you in individual emails. It's a much more efficient way for me to be a cryptozoologist online.
Okay. Why don't you tell me what's coming up for you in 2006?
Well, right now there's Creatures of the Outer Edge and the Unidentified are going to be republished. The Field Guide to Bigfoot and Mystery Primates is going to come out again in a new edition with a whole new index and a great update. And I'm working on a long-term project, which is a kid's book on cryptozoology. I don't know if I'll finish it this year, but I sure want to try. And then I'm very excited by the whole exhibition that's going to be at Bates College. We're going to have a whole university museum turning into a traveling exhibition. And it's going to have artists from around the world, you know, China, France, different places, pulling together some of their art that's been inspired by cryptozoology. And coming out with that is going to be a coffee table-sized book with different pieces of art from cryptozoology. And I did an introduction essay on cryptozoology, and there'll be articles in there about Cabinets of Curiosity and P.T. Barnum and cryptozoologists, as well as one on Charles Fort, really talking about how all of the unexplainable things that are connected to cryptozoology has influenced what's really a whole new art form in cryptozoology. So that's a very exciting long-term project, and I just can't know. You know, tomorrow I get a new call for a new place to go, or new animals discovered, or a new show to be on. So I'm very open and flexible to what the new year is going to bring me.
Awesome, awesome. All right, and where can people get the all your great cryptozoology books? On Amazon and through your website too?
Yeah, Barnes and Noble, Amazon,
and
all of those in the bookstores. Just type in Lauren Coleman online or on any of those websites. And then my personal website is laurencoleman.com, and then cryptomundo.com can get you to the daily blog.
Now, what's the origin of the name Cryptomundo? Because I really like it.
It's obviously crypto from hidden, and mundo is world. My favorite, when I graduated from high school in 1965, I don't know if you've ever heard of the movie Mondo Cani.
No.
It's a dog's world, and that was the theme song from that was the graduating song, but that was one of my favorite movies in 65 because it gave a real overview of a whole bunch of different things. So we took the Mundo from world with the U on it instead of the O, and that worked out pretty well.
Awesome.
Crypto Mundo, yeah.
Okay.